Good evening. When Das asked me to talk about this Diamond Sutra, I thought for a few moments he thinks I'm going to teach Diamond Sutra. Now, here we are going to some very deep waters here, because the Diamond Sutra is a Mahayana Sutra, and it's a big sutra, as we call it. No, it's not actually big, it's considered to be quite small in the, among the Mahayana Sutra. But it's quite a lot of it to be taught. And if you know the way, the tradition in the Mahayana tradition, like the tradition followed in Korea, China, and Japan, as well as in Tibet, not everyone can teach the sutras. Teaching of the sutra is limited to some very well-trained teachers. People like me, a layperson, unless I study the sutra, just the sutra for 10, 15 years, I cannot teach from that sutra. But we can always refer to it and make references to it. Now, in the, give me a chance to talk to you about some of this tradition about the, you know, the sutras and all this. In the Mahayana tradition, the sutras are contained in the what they call the Mahayana Tripitaka. The Tripitaka, Tripitaka means the three baskets, three sections of the sutras. Number one is in the Mahayana tradition, the Tripitaka is made out of the Sutta Pitaka. And then the second one is the Vinaya Pitaka. And then the third one will be the Commentaries Pitaka. The three sections of it. And this tree is divided in again into 36 sections. It's a very vast thing. If you go to a library in the a Chinese monastery, sometimes you can see on the shelf there, these books there. It's red with a golden printing, and the printing printed in a size, you know, very small size words, and they takes years and years to study. In fact, there's no one living nowadays who has studied all the Tipitaka. So they have got it's all a very specialized things. And from there, they divided the teachers into three different sections, roughly. Now, with the Sutta Pitaka, they've got the Sutta teachers. Right? In Chinese, it's, we call it this one, Jing Si. And then the Vinaya Pitaka, they got the, it's on the rules, the monastic rules. And they've got that. Right, this one is, the other words means lawyer, they are not lawyers, but they are the ones who are expert in rules. And the third one will be the commentary teachers. Okay, these are the three different sections. And what about the ordinary monks? Ordinary monks are called Fasu. They are the ones who learn a little bit of everything, and then they are also the ones who go and do chanting and all those other rituals and things. So, together with this, these four kinds of people comprise the teachers in Buddhism. People who belong to this category, the general category, are not permitted to, not to say permitted, but not qualified to teach any of these things. But they got to learn all these three so that when they talk about the Dharma, these are called the Dharma teachers. They got to know part of everything so that they can transmit the teachings to the public, to the Buddhists. Right? So I belong to neither these three, neither these four. Right? I can't even call myself fasu because I still got hair in my head. I don't wear a robe. Right? And you find that when they want to, in the tradition, when they want to find something about these rules, they got to really go and see somebody who is the teachers in this rule are expert in these rules. In modern days, we have got a few of these left, maybe one or two of these, very few of these left, but a lot of these people here. They are the ones who goes around talking about things. And the problem starts is when these Dhamma teachers try to be experts into this, then they teach the wrong thing. Right? Every one of them will go deeply into the suttas, and then they will be able to give you, explain to you clearly what the scriptures is are. Right? And even with these scripture teachers, there are people who are particularly experts on certain scriptures. You see, when you talk about these sutras in the Mahayana tradition, it's not just, you know, like the Theravada scripture where you got about 5, even 10 pages is considered to be a lot, isn't it? You read the Nikayas. For example, traditionally the Chinese version of the Diamond Sutra is this much. Right? And that is considered to be one of the smaller sutras. It took me only about an hour to finish reading this. Right? Not to understand it, but just reading it. But if I had to look into the other scripture called the Huayan Sutra or the Flower Garland Sutra, it takes me about 2 days to finish reading. So there's no one who can really be expert in all the sutras. So in every tradition, they have got one particular sutra, which is the main sutra. For example, the Flower Garland School, the Huayan School, they got the Huayan Sutra. Then they got, for certain other schools, they got the Lingyen Sutra and all these different sutras. And of course, the most popular one will be the Pure Land School, the Amitabha Sutra. Right? Amitabha Sutras, there are two of them. One is a shorter one, which you use for chanting. The other one is a longer one, which is used for studying. Right? So this is the way it is in the tradition in the Mahayana school. Right? And it's found in Japan, Korea, and all this. They got really people who are really experts in this particular thing. So people like me, a lay person, who do not really go deeply into it, we are not qualified to teach the sutta, but we are qualified to explain part of it and bring it in our Dhamma teachings. So towards this, tonight I'm going to just do just that, right, when you talk about it. Now, you talk about this Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism. Normally, when you talk about it, the difference is in the rituals, even the teachings, the rituals and the way, you know, the religion is carried on. But if you look at from the practical point of view, you can say that Mahayana Buddhism stressed more on faith, and the Theravada Buddhism stressed more on wisdom. Although Theravada Buddhism has got faith, but that particular kind of faith, as you know, as believing faith, is more in Mahayana than in Theravada. I can explain to you. I can explain those things by the way these two traditions approach the Buddha himself. As you know, in the Theravada Buddhism, we talk about the Buddha being a human being, right? Not? He was born as a little baby, and then as a prince, all these things. He eats, he sleeps, he get married, he get a child, then he left home, and then he went through the ascetic practice, and so on. Then eventually, he died. When he, of course, being respectful to the Buddha, we don't say the Buddha dies, we say the Buddha what? Went to parinibbana. So he went into demise, or passing away. When I say the Buddha died, people got upset with me, because it's being not respectful. But I said, well, the Buddha said death means death, isn't it? Alright, so the way we, but for many Theravada Buddhists, they want to make the Buddha to be a very special person. So from there, they start to make the Buddha into a sort of demigod and gods and all this. And that's why we got a lot of stories about the Buddha, what the Buddha did. He taught the devas, he did all these things and that. But you can see that this is not basically the nature of the Buddha. The nature of the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, or Siddhartha, he was a human being, very much a human being. The only difference between him and ordinary human being is the way we think he thought about things. Because we are full of a lot of attachment. For Gautama Buddha, he never have any attachment. He just, once he start to realize what attachment can do to people, he gave up the attachment. So there's no attachment in him. And because there's no attachment, according to some of the parables, the devil cannot enter him. Right? Whereas to us, we got so much attachment, every minute, every second, the devil enters. Right? We can, when you start having a thought, what is it? It's not. It's a thought to do with suffering. And the devil has got a lot to do with suffering. Now, when you come to talk about the Mahayana way of looking at the Buddha is no longer a human being. He's considered to be a sort of a meditation image sent out by another level of Buddha. Some of them say that he's sent by Amitabha Buddha to come into this world so that he can come and teach all of us about things. Now this is, you look at it, it's very close to many other religions of being sent by heaven to go there and teach human beings for their benefit, isn't it? There are some people who came born as the son of God, some became prophets, you know, given all the powers and all this. So that is because human beings like to think that way. And you find that in the Theravada Buddhism, you find that the Buddha can fall sick. You know, when he comes to olden age, he gets a backache and all this. It's that Ananda, you come and take over, I got my backache. Whereas in Mahayana Buddhism, there's never any reference to the Buddha being sick. How can a really holy thing get sick? So we bring the Buddha level a lot higher. And how high it is, I don't think anybody knows. Until now, these people who talk about the Buddha having all the different forms, different ways, are still arguing among themselves. Although they don't kill each other, but they're still saying, okay, whether the Buddha is this or that, or this or that. Whereas with the Theravada Buddhism, the Buddha is, or was, a human being. So there's one of the difference between this faith and wisdom. And in the Mahayana Buddhism, they are trying to balance these two in the early days. Faith and wisdom. The reason why it is because when you start to have too much faith, you start to lose your wisdom. You listen to what people tell you and start to believe in things. Whereas wisdom invites us to argue between ourselves, makes you think, right? Makes you think and makes you understand. Faith doesn't lead very much to understanding. It can be a beginning of your practice, but if you start to go solely on faith, it doesn't balance up with the other things. Now, if you look at the five faculties or the five powers, we call it the Pancha Balayani, in the Theravada Buddhism, in fact, it's not in Theravada, just only in Theravada Buddhism, it's also in all the Buddhist practice. The five faculties. What are they? Which helps you to gain your enlightenment. Right? You start with faith, you end with wisdom. Right? Then in between you got a concentration. I'm quite sure you all should know that.
Is this the same as the factors of enlightenment?
Yeah, it's the five of the 37.
Oh.
Right? You see, 4, 4, 4, 5, 5, 7 and 8, isn't it? It makes 37, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what are these four? Foundation of mindfulness. Okay? Foundation of mindfulness. What is this four? Right effort.
What's the other form? The right? They call it magical powers, right? Supernatural powers. Then the five faculties. And then the five powers. These are exactly the same thing, but faculties are present in us. The powers are what which we develop in our practice. And then what are the seven?
The pocaka.
Factors of enlightenment. And what's the eight?
Eightfold path, no?
Yeah. Eightfold path. Okay. So that is the 37 things. Right? And these five are these two. It's present in us, but it's very unbalanced. So you got to balance it so that you get the confidence and everything to be able to practice to go into this seventh and the seven factors, and then to be very clear with the eightfold path. Okay, so concentration, then mindfulness. Sorry, what is that? Mindfulness. No, I've lost one already. Which one is it? Mental block. Okay. Just you going back and check. Okay, check and see. Faith, concentration, mindfulness. I think effort, I think. Is it effort?
Vigor. V-I-G-O-R.
Five faculties. It's like samadhi.
Okay.
Prajna, sati, vigor, energy. Effort. Yeah. Mind effort. Yeah.
Effort and energy.
Okay. So these are the five. They've got to be well balanced. So when you have too much faith, you don't have much wisdom. What people tell you, you believe. Right? You find that they have the faith-based religion in the world, they're all like that. They tell you, okay, you must believe. Right? When I tell you believe so much that you listen to what I tell you, then you go there and kill people. You go there and convert other people. Right? So that is the faith. They lose the wisdom. What is the wisdom? Wisdom in Buddhism means understanding. Understanding of things, understanding of the nature of things. So we understand three things: dukkha, anicca, and anatta. Okay? Suffering, impermanence, and non-self, non-essence. Now, this eventually will have got something to do with this. Okay? So, in the as Mahayana develops, it goes deeply into this faith. They start to believe in faith, and then slowly all these things disappear. And disappear so much that they're talking so much about faith, about the nature of the Buddha, about all these sort of things, that they produce a lot of books, a lot of stories about it, and they forgot to do their practice to develop this understanding. And for years it's been happening that way until the guy who invented Zen Buddhism, Chan, Bodhidharma, he got so sick of all this, all this talking about faith, and he says, don't worry about faith. Practice, practice, practice. The practice is develop wisdom. And how you develop wisdom is not through arguments, not through study of books and all these things, but through reflecting, looking into yourself. What are you? Looking into the true nature. And from there, when you start to look into true nature, you go back to these three things. Right? So, slowly, the development from a very faith-based one into the one which goes back into wisdom again. Right? And but unfortunately, there was a lot of this philosophy and psychology which has gone on. And a lot of this folkloric things, it comes in to tell people about all the supernatural things. It still goes on, and it goes on in the form of Mahayana Buddhism. It also influenced the Theravada Buddhism as well. If you find out there is still a lot of belief
on the Buddha doing all the supernatural thing in Theravada Buddhism. Okay, whereas there's still the teachings in the Theravada scripture on these five. And while the Mahayana has gone deeply into faith, the Theravada Buddhist is still going to this. And maybe in the last 100 or so years, they're trying to bring that wisdom back into Mahayana Buddhism. For two or three decades, it was very successful. But because the lay people, like you and me, we want to believe in things. So what happens? We are going back slowly again into all these faith sort of things. Building temples is good. Of course, building temples is good, but we talk about, you know, building temples give you a lot of merits and so on. Right? Now, you find that in the Theravadan Buddhism, faith arises on confidence. Right? Whereas in Mahayana Buddhism, faith does not arise on confidence. It arises from the tradition from fear. Some of them, the way they look at it is, you know, if you are so scared of bad karma, then you become a Buddhist, isn't it? How many think that way? If you look at your own cultural background, you know that a lot of people think that way. I've even seen people, certain practice they say is very good, like, you know, not killing, then going to vegetarianism. So when they want to avoid bad results, badness in life, they go into vegetarianism. They become vegetarian and to avoid all these bad things. So in other words, it's no longer through your compassion and through your kindness that you adopt the belief and the religion. It's through fear. Right? And you can see that sort of fear exists in all faith-based religion. All right. Any questions so far? No? You can get it, right? Now, go back to the Diamond Sutra. It talks about grasping. When you talk about grasping, what do we grasp actually? The Buddha, it is inside here, Subhuti asks how to tame your mind. And the Buddha didn't actually use the word getting rid of your grasping. He says it's because of your grasping. Because we grasp onto a lot of things. Grasp into form, into sound, into how we taste and all these things. Right? And then we grasp into even to the Dharma, even to the Buddha. How do we grasp a Buddha?
Grasp onto like physical form.
Yeah, you think that we grasp a Buddha through images, isn't it? You build the images there and say, okay, that is the Buddha. And that is grasping on the Buddha. And grasping on the idea of the Buddha too. That's why in the early days when this sutta was being written, people do not fully believe that the Buddha is a supernatural person. They still think that the Buddha is a human being still. And this Dhamma Sutra is an early sutra in the Mahayana Buddhism. It could be the translation was done somewhere in the 3rd century AD. So that is about 600 years from the death of the Buddha. Which means that the sutta could have been written somewhere 2000 years ago. Right? And from there you can see that evolution is not complete yet. It's still got a lot of those Theravadan or so-called Hinayana elements in the teachings. And the Hinayana teachings is a lot about attachment. When you look at the later Buddhist teaching, it's no longer about attachment. It's about attachment to go to the Western heaven, isn't it? Why do you want to chant? Why do you want to believe in Amitabha? Because you can go to heaven. Before you die, Amitabha Buddha will come and take you to the heaven, and which you are is going to take. It becomes you take your soul to the heaven. Right? So it becomes that belief going back to the atta or going back to the person. So we go back to this grasping on everything. If you look at it, the 32 sections here tells you grasping on everything, how a thing looks, how a thing sound, even to the extent of, you know, giving of alms, doing a charity. Do you really get the grasp onto that? And what is grasping in a more common term?
Yeah, that is in it. Say, look at it. What? Right. Use the common word we use. Now, what does this attachment do? The early days, the Buddha taught only three parts. Right. Attachment leads to. Isn't it? Attachment leads to suffering. You all agree, because you've been through too many Buddhist courses. Now, before that, then what is that? What is the condition for attachment?
Craving, desire,
no. Becoming. You don't have this being there, you won't have attachment on it. If you don't exist, there's no attachment, right? Because you exist, there is attachment. Therefore, I bring dukkha. Now, I don't have to give you example of attachment to bring you dukkha. You all know that. Because we always look at the thing, you know, the really nasty things that happen to us. But what about, you know, when you talk about attachment, when you are attached to the idea of wanting to pass your exams? Is it a good thing or not? Of course, when you attach that thing, and then you want to pass the exam, that's a very good thing. But in the process of being attached to it, what it involve? You got to study very hard, isn't it? You got to attend lectures, isn't it? And if you don't like to attend the lectures, right, then that is suffering. But not, you see, things which we do, we seem to think that there is no suffering, right? Isn't it? The things which you like, there's no suffering. No. But the things which you like, if it goes wrong, then you suffer. Isn't it? How many of you have got very good relationship with others? Or maybe, you know, at your age, you all start to fall in love and all these things. Whatever you fall in love with, we don't worry. But have you ever have got that very strong wish to be with somebody, right? To have a good relationship with somebody? And let's put the positive things of relationship. And then what happens after that? You meet somebody, okay, I like him or her, whatever. Then I want to be close to him or her. Then that is that attachment, isn't it? Now what is involved in that attachment? You got to work very hard to improve the relationship. Now, supposing I like this person, I want to get near to this person. If the person doesn't like me, what happens? Go away every time I go near. Every time you go near, the flirt turn the other way. Then, because of your attachment, that is the suffering. Okay? Now, hypothetically, on the other hand, if that somebody likes you in return, right, you go there, I like you also. Go there hand in hand, you walk around and all this, right? Do everything together, play tennis together, come and listen to Unibat's lecture together. What happens if the other person doesn't like Unibat's lecture? Next time, I'm not coming with you. Then you don't feel nice.
that you got this dukkha. So in everything which has got attachment, there is dukkha. Even though the things which you think is very pleasant. You get a lot of money. Now, I'm quite sure a lot of you are broke sometimes. Send letters home and never get the money. They get upset. Of course, when supposing you go and pray very hard and then suddenly tonight you get a whole bag of money in your room. What happens? It's very nice, isn't it? You got no money and then suddenly you get a whole bag of money. What happens in you? You're very happy. But I think, hold it. Where am I going to store the money? Where am I going to keep the money? Right? Somebody might know that I've got so much money. They come and borrow my money. They come and steal my money. So the whole night you cannot sleep. What is that? So even with things which we consider to be very nice, there are also suffering. You cannot escape from it. So if there's nothing to do with attachment, supposing you are not attached to things, there's no attachment. For example, like, you know, if you are attached to a beautiful thing, and all of a sudden the thing disappears, you know, I don't have to tell you, you don't feel nice about it, there's suffering. But if you are not concerned over it, and say, okay, I've just lost a thing, and be able to understand that losing the thing is not a big deal, then you don't have attachment. Right. So, this is the very early teachings of the Buddha. Right? If you look at the early teaching, the Buddha says, you getting attached to things, then suffering. But as time goes up, people want to... Hello? People want more explanation about what happened. You get Max Club here. They want to know more about attachment. So the Buddha goes around explaining a bit further than that. Right? It says, you, this person, because of contact, therefore, you get craving. Right? And because of the craving, you get the intentions of doing things. And then you get suffering. From three things, expanded into five things. So, when you get this person contact with what?
Six senses.
Contact with form. What is form? A thing you can see and all this, right? Form, sound, what else?
Taste, hearing,
smell. This is very basic Buddhist knowledge, right? You're going to know. Form, sound, smell, what?
Taste.
Then you get feelings, body feelings. What do you call it? Touch. And then ideas. Right? Remember this, you cannot escape from this in your life. The moment you open your eyes, you see things. If you are not deaf, you hear things. Right? If your nose is functioning all right, you smell things, taste things, then you touch things. The touch doesn't mean that you've got to put your hand to touch. It means the touch of things onto you, the sensation of it, and then ideas. Right? You've got the brain, you can think, you've got the ideas. So, from there, this one, you start to develop craving for that. For example, like, when I take this tea, why I think the tea is nice? Okay, I drink this tea. There is a taste in it. Okay? And then if the taste is good, when I find that the taste is pleasant to me,
then I have got positive craving.
It's nice. Next time, can we have another cup of tea and so on? All these things. Right?
And then, if it's not nice,
take it away, I don't want it.
So, that is still craving. It's a negative craving.
So, craving is two of them, positive and negative, and it's craving for all these things.
Now, where does this form come from? Because you have got your eyes, you've got your ear, nose, etc., until you have got your brain. Or you can put it as mind. Right?
These are the six sense bases,
and from this, you come into contact with this, then you develop this craving. And then when you start to crave, it will go more of it.
It becomes your craving. It's because I like Chinese tea. Therefore, my craving is for Chinese tea. Right? My idea, and I cling on to it.
Sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4. No, before that. And my intentions is, the idea is to either say good or bad. That means it's through my judgment. I judge a thing, then I like, dislike. Now when I like, I drink all of it and I ask for another cup. If I dislike, I either leave the cup there or I throw the thing away or whatever.
And then I don't want it again.
What happens if somebody were to fill up your cup again?
Because of dislike, you get the intention of telling them, don't fill up my cup. Right?
So that's how, you know, a lot of times bring us to the suffering. The suffering is,
well, sometimes can be very, very subtle. Right? Sometimes it can be very, very strong.
And when there's a very strong suffering,
you get nervous breakdown, you get depression and all these things.
It's very little suffering, then you say, okay, it's all right.
I just get upset for a few minutes and then finish off with it.
Now, after a while, people still don't understand this. They still keep on asking questions. So the Buddha went more to elaborate more on more things on that. From there, from the contact, right? So you have got this person, then you have got developed this contact of this with this, and then you got the craving. No, from contact. Somebody might have asked the Buddha, what happens after contact and craving? Yeah, you got the sensation or feeling. I see one, from the contact to craving, there's this sensation of feeling first. And this sensation of feeling will be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay? And then from there, the sensation, then, it develops into craving. Craving, positive or negative, for what? All this. Form, sound, smell, etc. Okay? And then after that, the craving develops into clinging. You cling to the idea. It doesn't happen. Things don't happen in your mind like that. It takes steps to do it. Right? And then from the clinging, you develop what they call becoming. Or the intentions and ideas. And then from intention and ideas, there is this birth. Right? Birth of a deed of something which you do. Yeah. It's either in the thought or in the bodily action. And this birth is what we call the formation of karma. Right? Of karma. This karma in Chinese is what? way it is. My Chinese goes down the other way. Right? So, when it, anything which is, has got birth, it'll be aging and death. Now, birth means birth of an action. Karma means action.
Birth on action. What makes you want to throw this tea away? It's very simple, isn't it? It happens just very quick. Because I have got the eyes to look at the tea, I got the tongue to taste the tea. When I put the tea in my mouth, what happens? The tongue tastes the tea. And then it develops a sensation which is not very good. Right? It's unpleasant sensation to me. Then I develop that not wanting it. So it's negative craving. And then from there, I start to say, this is not my taste. That's the clinging. The clinging means I, my, and mine. Right? So not my taste. Therefore, I've got the intention of getting rid of the tea. Right? And then the birth of action, if I don't watch it, I start doing the action, meaning that I either don't drink it or throw it away. And then after that, after done doing the deed, if I let go, it's all right. It ages and it dies off. But sometimes the mind cannot get rid of it. So all these things return as a contact. And this time it's no longer the tea. It's the mind thinking. Right? Just thinking, how can those people give me horrible tea? Yeah. So you see how you develop this anger, how you develop your fear, how you develop your worries and all these things. If you don't cling on to ideas, if you don't have this attachment to things, then you get no grasping. And that's why in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha thought about this sort of things. It is nothing which you can consider to be Mahayana or Theravada about it. It is still the original teachings of the Buddha. It doesn't give you that sort of analysis, but it tells you what not to be attached to. You don't attach the looks of a person. You don't attach the looks of whatever you are doing. So that is the way for us to tame the mind. In the beginning chapter, Subhuti asked the Buddha, for the bodhisattvas, and when he means bodhisattvas, he means the lay people, the men, the laymen, and the laywomen. Right? How do we become a Samyak Sambuddha? Right? It's a very common Mahayana term, Sanyo Sanputi. Right? Samyak Sambuddha, how do we become a perfect Buddha? The Buddha says, and how do you become perfect Buddha? By training your mind. They call it by subduing the mind in Chinese, but we can translate as taming the mind. You tame your mind. Because our mind is unruly. Because our mind, we do not understand everything that goes with it. We bring the mind into what you call that autopilot. Right? You behave, we behave like that. You look at things we don't like. Straight away, we develop that aversion. And when you have the aversion, you look at it some more, think of it some more, it becomes hatred. Right? So you talk about, when the Buddha teach about great hatred, that's what it is. When something is good, you want some more. When something is bad, you develop dislike for it. And all this is through not understanding. Do not understanding the nature of things. What do you mean by nature of things? Three things. It's a dukkha, anatta, and anicca. You can put any sequence. But you've got to know that things change. The world changes every moment, every fraction of a second, it changes. And if we cannot understand the change, we get into the state of dukkha or suffering. Right. Okay, any questions so far? Yes?
You mentioned that the Dharma Sutra teaches us like what not to attach to, right? But is there anything we should be attached to? Or is there anything that's good to be attached to?
According to Buddha, there's nothing good to be attached to, but what we surmise from the Buddha's teachings, there are certain things, but which are not things, right? which is good to, not to be attached to, but which is good to develop. It's not found in the Diamond Sutta, because it talks about the negative things. Right? But when you look into the other positive teachings of Buddha, what are they? Four things. Or you look into the Mahayana version, there are six things. Six plus four. The four Brahma Viharas. Loving kindness, Metta Karuna, Mudita, and Upekkha. These are the... Now, we've got to be very careful with it. Do not get attached to them either. Practice them, have them, develop them, but let them come and let them be with you all the time. Now I can give you a case where, you know, attachment to so-called compassion is no good. Now if you go to Asia, you find that in this marketplace there are sometimes, you know, all these stray dogs, isn't it? And one day, this is a story, but it can be true in some parts of it. One of these very faithful Buddhists went around, right, having his food there, and then a dog was there and then stealing somebody's food. You know, stray dogs, they always steal food. So the dog got bitten by the fellow whose food was stolen. Okay, then this very good pious Buddhist came and scolded the man. He says, "You shouldn't beat the dog like that. You see, you're causing a lot of suffering to the dog. After all, he only take a little bit of your food and he gets so upset." So then after that, after scolding the man, he took the dog home and says, "No, I'm a good Buddhist. I got compassion. I want to save you." So took the dog home, bathed the dog, then tie up the broken bone. Then of course, you got to feed the dog, isn't it? And he's a good Buddhist. He's, what dogs eat? Meat, isn't it? So his house got no meat. And he doesn't believe in giving meat to the dog. So give the dog his vegetarian food. Vegetables, and the dog won't eat. So he started to preach to the dog. He says, "That's it, the whole problem with you, dog. You always eat meat. That's why you got bad karma. You got bad karma, people beat you up." Now, see you now. That compassion without understanding. Isn't it? Of course, the dog won't eat. How can the dog understand your Buddhist preaching? But of course, because of his faith, he said that, "Oh, the Buddha can preach to animals, can preach to devas, I can preach to the dog." So he preached the dog, started asking the dog to be vegetarian or this. The dog won't even bother. And then finally he got upset. He took a stick out and beat the dog. See that? Therefore, this compassion can go very wrong if you do not understand compassion itself. So, when you talk about this Brahma Vihara, loving kindness is not something which we force ourselves to have. If you look at it, when can loving kindness come up? At the moment when your mind has got no hatred. When your mind has got some attachment and hatred, loving kindness, genuine loving kindness, can never come up. So that's why the Buddha teaches how to get rid of grasping, because grasping causes hatred. If you start to be able to look into how we get attached to things, and therefore we get our hatred worked out, therefore we cannot develop loving kindness, or for the matter, compassion. So that's why the basic teaching is to get rid of your attachment. Otherwise, there's no point in telling you to do all the good things. So if we get a misunderstanding of the whole thing, then we cannot develop all these good things. Therefore, we when you talk about it, the attachment is not attachment to good things. It's allowing good things to develop in us. It becomes natural. I don't say that just because I'm a good Buddhist, I got to have metta. It's not that. You develop metta when you get rid of your hatred. When you start having your hatred, you can never have metta, proper metta in you. Okay, any other? What about the 6 good qualities?
It's from the Mahayana point of view, is it?
6 perfections.
You look under the 6 virtues, is it?
6 perfections. Is
it? Yeah.
Wisdom. Wait, hold on.
The first one, the Buddha.
Is there Riya in Mahayana?
Yeah. We call it paramita. It's called perfections of virtue, which every one of the Buddhists must cultivate. In the Theravada tradition, they got 10. But in the Mahayana tradition, there are 6. They're all very close together. Because the other 4 can be found in other parts of the teaching. So we got
precepts. Samadhi. Actually, it's jhana, not samadhi, sorry. Jhana. Dhyana.
No.
It's, in Sanskrit, it's D-H-Y-A-N-A.
No, dhyana. Dhyana is... dhyana is actually chan.
Chan. Is it?
Dhyana is... Both is called dhyana. You can talk about dhyana. Is Chan or Zen. That is just the practice.
Because let me see actually. Dana, sila, so virtue, kasanti,
where?
Patience, effort. Okay. That's dhyana according to Wikipedia.
Santi.
Santi, yep. And santi. Russia, which is wisdom.
And then Panya. No, it is Prajna. Okay, for those of you who are not familiar with all these words, dana is generosity. It means giving. I think the original word for dana is rice. I think, I'm not sure, but it's both in Bali and Sanskrit the same, right? Virya is energy or effort. Right? Sila is morality. Right? Samadhi is concentration and mindfulness, right? And then Santi is patience. And Panya is wisdom. Okay, these are the 6. Now, these are the, why you call perfections? Because if you do this really well, you will become a Buddha. It's one of the conditions. Now, we talk about different roads leading to become Buddha, Buddhahood. Right? One of the ways is doing the 37 steps, right? Just now I wrote down all the 37 things. The other way to go to is to develop this perfection. But you find that when you are doing this, you are also developing this. And then plus, of course, both of them will tell you loving kindness. Compassion. What else? Joy or sympathetic joy, and then equanimity. Loving kindness means you have got a sort of good feelings towards others. Compassion means having that proper understanding
of others. It doesn't necessarily mean that when the fellow is sick or suffering, you understand him. In all aspects, you got to learn how to understand people. The joy means you appreciate what people do. Right? And then try to be nice and kind to people. Try to, you know, this joy itself, the sympathetic joy, can make you work with other people in a better way. Corporations, you know, to cooperate with others, you need to have that. And then when you start to do this three, you find that the mind is always level. It doesn't fluctuate very much. And so you find that in the Theravada situation, aspect, you have got this. You also got all these things incorporated in the Theravada tradition. So in other words, when we practice Buddhism, it's not just one aspect of it. In some teachings, they teach you just one thing, to have faith. Isn't it? In a Pure Land situation, there's only one thing required, faith. And then they tell you how to develop, you know, how to make use of faith. You do chanting all the time. So does it really help or not? When a teaching is all completely faith-based, then you've got to believe in what people tell you. In the Western religion, they're all faith-based. So they tell you what to do, they tell you how to live, and so on. And the Buddhist version of it is the Pure Land tradition. Whether it's good or bad, we don't know. Whether Amitabha Buddha is coming to see you on the deathbed or not, how do you know? According to the Amitabha Sutta, he says if you chant Amitabha Buddha's name solely, you know, full of concentration for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, up to 7 days, right? Then when you are dying, Amitabha Buddha and all the holy ones will come and take you away. Right? Going over to the Western paradise. But whether it's true or not, we do not know. But whether it's achievable or not, we also do not know. Because it's very strict. It says you must chant until your mind doesn't move. Right? So when your mind doesn't move, what does it mean? All this thing happening. So when you talk about faith-based, that is the way Buddhism developed into faith. When you look at the first teaching of Buddha in the Turning of the Wheel Sutra, the Buddha did not mention about faith. Understand yourself, knowing why you get into problems. And then when you get to know why you get into problems, and then how you help yourself out of the problems to the Eightfold Path. The Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta tells only of the Eightfold Path, right, and explain to you why you get your suffering through your grasping. But eventually, as Buddhism flows through all the ages and being influenced by outside religion and thinking, it became a philosophy. Right? And it became a sort of a very much of a faith-based religion, although not in all sides. Right? There are a lot of parts of Buddhism which is not based on solely on faith. So you got a faith and wisdom. In between that, what do you get? Concentration, mindfulness, and your energy. Right? So we got to develop these five. And when you start develop these five, you find that slowly your life starts to change. You find that you are more aware of the attachment you have on things. How attached you are to things. The first thing you will notice is the negative things which cause you a lot of problem. How you attach to it. Then slowly it becomes finer and finer. Until one fine day you say, okay, I'm going to give up everything. And when you give up everything, no more attachment, what do you become? Enlightened person. You become an arahant. And you might even become a Buddha, we do not know. Because the difference between Arahant and the Buddha, according to Mahayana, is because the Buddha doesn't have a teacher. He comes out within himself. Whereas the Arahant got to listen to the teacher's teaching and become enlightened. But there's no difference between it. Enlightened and non-enlightenment. An Arahant can also be a very good teacher. The Buddha is also a very good teacher. And if they say that the Arahant cannot teach like the Buddha, well, there's a lot of evidence in the scripture. The Buddha, when the Sariputta went to teach outside, Sariputta is the disciple of Buddha. Sometimes he's going to teach to others. And when the Buddha heard Sariputta's teaching, the Buddha says, "You preach like the Buddha." So whether you become Arahant or become the Buddha, doesn't matter. Your goal is there. To us, important goal of being a Buddhist is to get enlightenment. And if you don't get enlightened in this life, you can always hope for next life. But you don't work hard enough in this life, you will never get a good next life to go and practice. So the fact that that's the belief. So we got to really practice hard. And practicing hard doesn't mean that you sit on the mat all the time. Practicing hard is to learn to look into your mind, how much attachment you have. And that's why the particular sutta, the Dhamma Sutta, talks about this attachment. Attached to various things, even attached to the religious teachings itself. It talks about the attachment to the Dhamma. Then for people who do not understand, they say, "Oh, if I don't get attached to the Dhamma, so I don't worry about the Dhamma." The Buddha says it's not like that either. You don't get attached to the Dhamma, you don't get attached to non-Dhamma. And that's where the difficulty understanding is. A lot of people don't understand it. But if you really practice and look through attachment, you know that attachment is not just on one thing. It's attachment to everything. All right, so any questions? Sita's history is very dull. It's a retreat. It's not the kind of thing which, you know, you can bring a lot of interesting things in. When you talk to it, because it's very serious things. Right? And serious things in Buddhism is very dull. You fall asleep sometimes and you want to leave the room sometimes.
So what are some of the main things that Buddha in the sutra said not to be attached to?
Looks. Apparent images, ideas. They can put their ideas, because on ideas itself, there are about something like 15 chapters of it. So it tell you one thing after another, one thing after another.
Coming from a non-Buddhist background, how does next life works?
It's just a belief, right? Nearly all Buddhists will believe in the next life. Nearly all, I would say. Yeah. So, but the thing is, we don't have to worry so much about the next life. You see, when we start to worry about next life, then all our practice will be for the next life. The Buddha did mention the next life, but the Buddha also mentioned, if you practice now, your next moment will be better. Isn't it? We start to clear off a lot of things, then you get less worries tomorrow. Then that is the better next life for you. So our next life is just the next round of existence.
But it's still the same consciousness. You are still the same person. I mean, the same consciousness.
Yeah, you change, right? So tomorrow you are a different person. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Tomorrow you got a different, just looking at it, tomorrow you got a different life. That, but if you can change, you can change yourself in this life and start to have less attachment, then tomorrow, in your next life, you have a better next life. Right? If you look at these sort of things, then it makes sense, doesn't it? But if you think of the next life, now, a lot of stories tell you, this next life business. Next life, if you are a nice person this life, next life you'll be a rich person. So that is a belief. Right? What people tell you. But you know that from this, even within this life, if I change my mind on getting less attachment now, the next life I'll have less worries and less suffering. Like tomorrow, maybe 1 hour later, maybe next moment. So we can say that this rebirth is within this long life of ours. So does it make sense to you, the next life business?
Well,
we see the thing, we look at it, we change all the time. But if we can start to change according in a nice way, then your tomorrow will be better. Supposing now you got a lot of worries, you worries because of attachment. You can get rid of all the attachment, tomorrow you got a life will be very nice, isn't it? But why can't you do that? Or why can't I do that? Because we have got this attachment. We cannot get rid of it. So the Buddha is teaching us how to get rid of attachment. Now, when you look at this one, talking about the 9 steps, it is very similar to the dependent origination, isn't it? That is the dependent origination as outlined by the Buddha in the Mahanidana Sutta. Go and look for it in the Digha Nikaya. It tells you 9 steps.
That's it.
I think you erased it.
So is it part of the dependent origination?
No, it is the dependent origination.
But just broken down differently.
Yeah, because the twelve is a later development. So you can say the 3, but human being, attachment and dukkha, number 1. People don't understand it, so it broke down into 5, and then after that into 9, then later development into 12. But this 12, unfortunately, is being made use of to explain why you are born in the next life. So they say 3 lifetime and 1.5 lifetime. So they haven't settled the score yet, so we don't worry about that. The more relevant one will be the one there. But if you look at it, the 9 steps still contains the 12. You know why? In the person itself, if you understand, if you hear the 12 steps, the person itself has got the 6 sense bases, has got the consciousness and everything already in the human being. So it makes the 9 is easier to understand, and the 9 is linear, and we make use of this 9 to explain your action rather than your rebirth next life. So in other words, when you understand grasping, your idea about next life will be a lot clearer. It's no longer I'm going to be born as a cockroach next year, next life or what. A lot of people tell me next life I'm going to be born as a chicken, because when I was young I slaughtered a lot of chicken. So I don't know how many lives I got to live to pay back on my debt. Now, this sort of thing is very common in religious teaching, right? And we should try not to get into that sort of belief, right? You should see when you do something like that, it's what's left in your mind that is making you uneasy. And that is the dukkha you're feeling. When you do something you got to regret, that is dukkha. Why not follow the Buddha and try to not to do those things and don't have the regret? Any other questions? No? Now, you know why this is so uninteresting? Because it's the core of Buddhism. You're getting right into the middle, right? Because we are talking about karma. Everybody knows karma. Karma is what you do. We share with the Hindus in this belief in karma. But in dependent origination, the Buddha doesn't ask you to believe in karma. It explains to you how karma takes place. Why do you want to come here? Can you explain the karma? Or not? Just think, why you attend the talks tonight?
Good karma.
that is superstition. Now, what happens if you come and sit down there, good karma, then you get so boring that you feel like leaving now?
Bad karma.
Now, why do you want to come here, okay? You got to trace back. Now it goes, it's not only yesterday, you know. You know, it doesn't mean that, oh, I heard there's going to be a talk, I'll come here. You know. It's got to do with the time when you're small, how you're influenced and all these things. You know, it makes your personality, and then slowly, because of what is happening, therefore, it becomes the next step and the next step. So if you go around and start to think about a lot of things, this karma business makes sense. Why do you want to study the course you're studying? Why? All to do with attachment, isn't it? If you would, you don't have attachment now. A lot of us will, if you don't want to get rid of attachment, just everything. A lot of us will have to become monks, right, get rid of it and then go in. But again, that is not practical for a lot of us. We still got to, we still have some attachment. That is what we call the pragmatic way of looking at it. But we are trying to make sure that those attachments do not give us a lot of problems. It's very important. Now, just like the relationship story I told you just now. When you see somebody you like, okay, go then approach somebody, hoping to start a love affair or something. If the fellow don't like you, just walk away. Okay, give up. Don't get attached, go back and then look for somebody else. Or go back and do your studies and forget about the person, isn't it? But why can't you forget about it? Because of the strong craving and clinging, right? That thing, that person I like the looks of him or her, I like the way the fellow smile, or I like the way the fellow sit, all the ideas you give yourself and the clinging. But if you are like the Buddha, or if you follow the Buddha, it's all to do with clinging. Give up the clinging. Go back and study. And the thing why the Buddha says we cannot do it is because of avijja, the ignorance we have. We are not clear on things. We don't understand things, we cannot get rid of it. Even though we know it, that the guy will fall into get into trouble, we still want to do it because of avijja also. Avijja means also stubbornness. So the Buddha says, look through yourself. Don't go and pray to the Buddha. The Buddha is no longer here. You go and pray to Buddha, it doesn't work. You work on yourself. And that's why we look into Buddhism as a religion which is where you bring your own power to yourself.
Actually, there's this particular phrase in the sutra itself. When they were talking about the four stages of enlightenment, and then they're trying to, you know, and then it's like you were saying, can a stream enterer think that he himself has entered a stream enterer? Has been a stream enterer? No, I don't think so, because in reality, there's nothing to enter. Therefore, I am called a stream enterer.
Yeah. And it tells you where.
They did repeat that for all four stages until Arahant as well.
It's mentioned here.
Yeah.
A stream enterer is not a stream enterer.
Yeah.
Well, that's of course that's philosophical and then you're based on rhetoric and all these things. But you don't look at the thing as what it is and say it must be like that. When you start to look at it, it must be like that, then there's no change. Then the Buddha's teaching on anicca or impermanence is not true.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So we. That's why the whole thing is, it itself, it refutes a lot of the popular beliefs in this one. Yeah. And it should be, actually, I only wish that there are some teachers who are very good at teaching Dhamma Sutra can teach, but I don't think you all will have time. Going through this whole thing is about, sometimes they do it for 14 or 15 days. How can you all spare 14, 15 days? Right? Unless you go on a retreat. No, it's true, because in the olden days, when there is a famous sutta teacher, the sutra teacher comes and want to teach a sutra, people go on retreat. They go and stay in the temple. Just like you all do meditation retreat, 14 days, 15 days. Morning after your early breakfast, you go there and sit down there and listen. If you've got a book, you have one book. If not, you just listen. Sometimes you listen to only half of it. Then after that, adjourn for lunch. Then come back in the afternoon. Then at night, there'll be discussion. That's what they do, traditionally. Of course, nowadays, the Buddhist scholarism is no longer there. You don't learn that much. And that's why Mahayana now goes into belief. At least you got the Theravadins, they go for your meditation retreat. Of course, a lot of people go there just to blush and not to work, that's all. Everything, people cook for you and everything.
This day, Theravada also go a lot to pray,
to be honest. What do you all do when you go to Badanun?
Sorry?
What do you all do when you stay 2 days in Badanun?
Meditate.
just think, next time you go to Badanun, or do something. Quintal Pramanat will help you sweep the temple grounds. Because that's what a lot of monks do nowadays. They cannot do other jobs, so they sweep. That's why in Lumiere you go to the Wat Pa Buddha Rangsi, our Chakun Samai's temple. It's always so clean. Because every morning the monks will sweep the floor, sweep the whole ground. Because that sweeping is very good. It makes you focus, and then you start to get rid of your grasping for the time being.
Anyone
got
any more questions? No.
Okay. It's good to get all people are enlightened. Maybe I'm the only one who's not enlightened here.